The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at tntradio.live. You're with Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Those are fairly strong words from Chuck Schumer, as you've been hearing in our news, like basically saying we've got to get rid of the Prime Minister of Israel, which, of course, US agencies have been, circulating and making public in the last 4 days. We knew that. We've been talking about that on the program. And as I said, I wouldn't put that past the CIA to make happen, to get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu in a surreptitious way. But they're now going head on, and Chuck Schumer is obviously the one that the Democrats elected to attack Netanyahu and call for an election. So the relations between the United States and Israel have never been at a lower point, and because Israel are doing mostly what the United States don't want them to do at the moment. Meanwhile, still in the Middle East, Yemen's rebel Houthis claim to have tested a new hypersonic missile. Hypersonic missile. These are the Houthis. I don't know, because we're not there, we don't get a true feel or understanding of how powerful the Houthis are. Well, first of all, they seem to be unstoppable. They seem to have a very high success rate, despite the bombings that they've copped at the hands of the UK and US forces. They're obviously supported by Iran, and now they're talking about hypersonic missiles. They're not in fishing boats firing slingshots at the bows of major freighters. They are playing a significant terrorist game in that waterway. Yemen's Houthis claim to have tested a hypersonic missile as they announced they will extend their attacks on Israel-linked ships in the Indian Ocean. Russia's state-run RIA Novosti reported the claim, citing an unnamed official, but provided no further evidence. However, the Iran-backed rebel group have been hinting at surprises they have planned for US and allied forces countering their attacks in the Red Sea. A hypersonic missile would allow Houthis to penetrate advanced air defences, according to the Maritime Executive, a global maritime publication, pointing out they are harder to target than ballistic missiles as they have greater manoeuvrability. RIA Novosti reports that the missile is capable of reaching Mach 8, and is entering the manufacturing phase. It said Houthis plan to use the missile on targets in the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden, and in Israel. So there you have it. On one side of the world, you've got this terrorist group, you know, financed and supported by Iran and given weapons by Iran, no doubt. It's a hypersonic missile from Russia or Iran, talking about using what will be almost undefeatable weaponry in that area. And then on the other side of the world, you've got Putin yesterday talking about nuclear weapons. When are we going to put an adult in charge of the White House so that the rest of the world stands up and takes notice and doesn't think they can get away with anything because the bloke in the White House is just sound asleep? When will that happen? Now, I wanted to get to Robert Clancy. I'll get to him in just a second. If you want to be part of the conversation today and you want to call in on our talkback lines, please do so from the United States and Canada, 1-888-201-6425. From the UK, 033-0024-1026. Or from Australia and New Zealand, 1-800-670-310. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Clashing on the controversies.
It's a woke society, and I am fed up with it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good to have your company. You're going to enjoy this. Many of us have learned important medical lessons in the past 4 years because of the pandemic. It's clear that many of the so-called experts failed on so many fronts. Much of the official advice that we got on social distancing, on lockdowns, face masks, vaccine efficacy, vaccine safety, and the treatment of COVID-19 has now been proven that it was simply scientifically irrational. Vested interest and profit motives in part explain the disastrous policies, but a serious lack of scientific understanding is clearly apparent among many medical professionals, and we saw that during the pandemic. My next guest is sure to have insights in this and more. Robert Clancy AM is Emeritus Professor at the University of Newcastle's School of Biomedical Sciences and Pharmacy. He was the Foundation Professor of Pathology in the University of Newcastle Medical School and a clinical immunologist who undertook research in mucosal immunology and the development of mechanisms to enhance mucosal resistance and control mucosal inflammation. Professor Robert Clancy, welcome to TNT.
Good to be here, Chris.
In many areas, it's now clear the medical authorities got the science wrong on COVID. In your view, what were the biggest failures?
It's the correct question, and it's a very difficult question, and I'm sure a lot of people, Chris, have different answers to it. My view is this, that over a long period of time, in Australia, we had an extraordinary development of public health issues, measures, and underpinning science as a result of our response to a series of pandemics dating from 1900 and the bubonic plague in Sydney through a series of flu pandemics. Now, as a result of that, we developed a plan to face the next pandemic, which was expected to be a respiratory tract virus, probably flu, but not necessarily, because we'd already had experience in the early 2000s with some unusual coronaviruses, which of course became the basis of COVID. And so in 2019, we had a world-class plan to cope with the next pandemic. And that plan was very much reflected as a result of the Australian initiatives and developments in the WHO plan. When COVID arrived, the plan was sitting there. We trained for it. I was talking to some colleagues the other day and in Queensland, and they were saying, oh, they would go out into the local oval and train in different ways for this next pandemic. It all went to seed. It was never looked at, never referred to, never enacted. Now, in that plan, as a result of the development of the basic science, understanding that there was a difference between injecting a vaccine, which was extremely good for preventing things like measles and any other bug that happened to go through the bloodstream to make you sick, and affecting protection at the surfaces of the lung or the gut, the mucosal surfaces. Mm. Now, that was all known, and in the plan, of course, it mentions vaccines. Vaccines have been incredibly valuable, in fact, used in pretty much every pandemic we've had. Yep. But they're not centre. Because we know the restrictions on an injected vaccine for a compartmental infection in the airways, they're separated, they're different. We knew that we could expect some protection against severe disease, probably no prevention against getting infected in the first place or transmitting infection. I mean, this is basic science. It's not me being clever or anyone else being clever. This should have been known. Now, these are very important observations. But
Professor, we had health officials, senior state health officials telling us that, if we take the vaccine, we won't be spreading it, we won't be contracting it. And secondly, there was nothing in that national pandemic response paper that said we had to lock down either.
Yeah, but Chris, you might notice that none of those health professionals were students at the University of Newcastle. I do joke. But I think what happened is that a lot of those people, many of whom, I'm not sure they're still my friends, but they certainly were friends and they are friends and colleagues, they really did not understand the biology. It's not their thing. They were very good maybe at pharmacy, pharmaceutics, they sometimes wonder, epidemiology, but they certainly didn't understand the immunology. And the immunologists that appeared were not people who understood mucosal immunology, the immunology of surfaces. They were mainly mouse immunologists who were very loud. There were all sorts of people who worked on T cells and B cells, but very few who understood the very basics of mucosal immunology.
So we needed to be led by the likes of Robert Clancy and other mucosal immunologists.
No.
It would have been nice
if someone like me had been asked for an opinion. I actually offered it, but never got a response. And it's But it's more, it's deeper than that, Chris. It was suddenly on Australia who had been developed a program where we said, look, we must define the epidemiology to determine how we have a public health response. Now, they did this, Stanford University did this. They did it in March of 2020. By March of 2020, the true epidemiological characteristics of a significant, concerning infection that was create 40% of which were asymptomatic infections. The target for serious disease were defined individuals who were my age, they were older, or they had collateral disease. Those issues were all understood by March 2020. And that should have defined the public health response. And it did define it in what's called the Great Barrington Declaration, which you may be familiar with.
Yeah.
You may have talked about. Now, that was essentially enacted in Sweden. Now, Sweden made a big mistake. They did not protect the vulnerable as well as they should have. I mean, remember, this was a time of great panic, always is with a pandemic. And it was a time when they were getting their gears together. If Sweden had been a little more focused on looking after the vulnerable, they would have had an even better outcome.
Yeah,
but if you have a look at Sweden and Australia, for example, where we had those lockdowns and the panic of vaccines that were never going to be highly effective and likely to be highly toxic, Sweden had 50% less infections than we did, 50% less. Mm. If you look at the mortality, about 80% of Sweden's deaths were in that first year when there was a pretty nasty variant there and they were still getting their act together and trying to protect their innocent. 80% of those deaths were in people who were in care, 80%. Mm. So when you look at the total infections. Mm. But it did not change the pattern of mortality in Sweden. So if you look at the all-cause mortality, even though those who would promote the way we approach things with lockdowns, we had an increase in mortality, which has continued, not related to COVID, possibly related to the vaccine, as I'm sure you've discussed on many occasions.
Very, very much so.
Yeah. And what happened in Sweden was they had the lowest all-cause mortality in Europe. I'm one or two others pretty similar. Very low, much lower than we did.
Yeah.
They more or less followed the epidemiological principles defined by Stanford University, which we should have done.
Yeah, we should have done it. I wanted to talk about treatments. Because we put all our eggs into the vaccine basket, Robert, we jumped on this idea that treatments could get us over the line. And as it's turned out, we should have gone down the idea of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. We should have gone down those routes because they would have been effective. Your recent article in Quadrant titled "The Curious Case of Hydroxychloroquine" shows how a cheap, safe drug was suppressed as an effective treatment for COVID. And when it came to COVID, we were told that every life mattered, but we couldn't go anywhere near these two treatments. It was horrific, wasn't it?
Look, we can talk about the vaccines and we can talk about, people not understanding the basics. All they had to do is go back and look at 80 years' experience of a flu vaccine and they would have completely understood what they could expect and, in fact, what actually happened, plus the toxicity of a genetic vaccine, which is very different to a classic antigen vaccine.
Yep.
But if you go... I mean, the only time I've used the word shameful, and I use it advisedly, is what happened in terms of early treatment.
Yeah.
What is shameful is that various power politics imposed on the doctor-patient relationship, the way if you're a family practitioner or I'm a specialist, seeing a patient, I sit down, you'd sit down, and you talk with the patient, and you'd identify what was the issue, what the options were, and you would enact those. And part and parcel of my everyday management of patients today, yesterday, months, years ago, has been the use of off-licence drugs. I probably do it more often because I see people with rather unusual, bizarre illnesses for which no one has done big trials. And so The use of off-label drugs is part and parcel of patient management.
Yeah.
Suddenly, that was taken away from the doctor. So the imposition...
Well, not only that, the doctors who prescribed it, there's one case in court today of Mai Lee, who I'm going to talk with after this interview. She's lost her ability to be a GP because of this.
It's shameful, shameful. The interesting thing was that not only was it imposed by essentially bureaucrats, essentially tied up, I understand, we've never seen these contracts, with the contractual arrangements made for the messenger RNA vaccines, that you're not allowed to have anything that might prevent them being released.
Yeah.
We had patients die because they were not able to access. Every nursing home should have been given, first of all, hydroxychloroquine, and then the combination with doxycycline, zinc, and then as soon as ivermectin came on board, add that in. They should have been there.
Yeah.
They're harmless drugs used in the context of 3 or 4 or 5 days of treatment. The data was there. The data has got better.
Shameful
and better.
Is the right word for it, isn't it? Shameful.
Yeah, it is shameful. And I don't regret saying that. It probably, I'm not sure they'd bother taking my license away, but it is shameful.
Okay. And I want to take a quick break. I want to take a quick break. I'll come back with you in 30 seconds and we'll talk further. There's so much more to cover with our guest today, Professor Robert Clancy on TNT.
TNT's Jason Allbourn.
What that sneaky World Health Organization, that private organization linked to the United Nations, is planning to do to take away yours and my medical sovereignty. Or pretending that they're not going to, of course, because it just so happens that they have got the ability to look into a crystal ball, see around corners, and tell us that there is yet another virus or disease or sickness coming for us, and the only way that we survive it is to do exactly what Tedros tells us to do, even though the man's not even a doctor. Can't even tell his own Ethiopian country on 3 separate occasions, goodness me, that they have had a cholera outbreak. Cholera characterized by acute watery diarrhea that, if not diagnosed correctly, can result in death. Well, on 3 occasions, Tedros's answer was, we didn't have good enough testing or testing available, so we didn't really know that it was cholera. That's the guy who's leading the world.
Weekends with Jason Allbourn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification. 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are opportunity zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
The human mind is like a computer, no matter how efficient it may be. Its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Professor Robert Clancy is my guest today. Now, I understand you'll be speaking at an important conference in Sydney on the 2nd of April, featuring Dr. John Campbell and also Professor Colleen Aldor. Dr. John Campbell's YouTube channel, which covers many COVID and vaccine issues, and I've seen so many of them, has over 3 million subscribers. He's visiting Australia from the UK to attend the conference. What do you expect to come out of that?
Well, I'm hoping John has a bit of a break because he's staying with us, and he's really here on a social visit on the fact that he's just become a grandfather and he's got a new grandchild in Perth.
He's on a holiday.
He's on holidays, but he was He's a marvelous person, he's very kindly offered to be involved. We've sort of decided to assemble around John's presence here a national conference, in a sense, where we're trying to do the Royal Commission that the government hasn't got round to looking at yet. I can see why they don't want to do one, but we'll do it for them. It's going to look at the issues that you've been raising, Chris, the issues of the epidemiology, the issues of the vaccine, drugs, drug use, particularly also the economics and the legal aspects. So we're going to do a rather sort of broad-based cover, and that's on the 2nd of April. If anyone is interested, and I hope they are, and I know a lot of John's fans, he has many Australian fans, would be interested. They can access this through the AMPS website, and all the details of registering, but they must hurry because there's only 350 seats.
Okay. Now, the other point I wanted to raise with you was recent information from the New Zealand group of scientists who looked at 99 million cases and discovered that the observed dangers and side effects of these COVID vaccines were in some cases three times more than what was expected. We now have affirmative proof that these vaccines were more dangerous than what we were being told.
Oh, I think the data has been around for a long while in different formats. It's not surprising. Think about what you're doing. You're injecting not a normal crushed up bug to stimulate an immune protective response. You're actually injecting the genes that make a bit of the crushed up bug.
Yeah.
And so the genes, we know they're distributed throughout the body. Initially we were told they'd be localized, which was that was wishful thinking. We know it's distributed. We know it potentially can go into any cell. So you have a situation where you've got potentially every cell in the body making on its surface, as a result of the genes that have gone into that cell, a foreign protein, the spike protein, which you want to stimulate antibody. But normally, of course, that will just be in the lymph nodes draining where you inject your vaccine. But this is in all these cells. And so what happens? You make some antibody, which is good. That protects you against serious disease to an extent. But at the same time, you're putting up a foreign protein that the body will see as like an autoimmune disease and kill.
Yeah.
And so you have these things called T cells, which love to kill something that's foreign. And they're sitting up there, and it's not surprising that you get neurologic damage, cardiac damage, all sorts of different damages, things we've never seen or seen very uncommonly in the past.
And we're starting to get enough data as well since the pandemic to prove that there is a direct causation between the vaccine rollout and excess deaths, aren't we?
This is the big unanswered question, isn't it? I'm hoping John Campbell will talk a little bit about this because he's taken it up a lot on his video scheme on YouTube.
Yeah.
And it's the best way of monitoring whether a pandemic on one hand or a vaccine on the other is being effective is looking at all-cause deaths, because that's giving you a denominator and a numerator that you can actually measure and get an impact of. Now, what's happened across the vaccinated world is that correlating not with the disease but with the vaccine program being put out, you get this increase between 10 and 20% higher levels of mortality. And this particularly occurred in 2022, dropped down a little in 2023, and of course we're looking at it now. And we know that patients can die from the vaccine because post-mortem studies have been done showing the spike protein and the immune response to it in the heart, for example, and different organ systems. So we know that this can happen. And when we look at a population, we're seeing a population with the closeness of the mortality to the vaccine program. And you can, various people use different criteria that have been looked at over many years to get a closer a linkage between this. I think the concern is that no one's come up with a better explanation. That's number one. And number two, the governments do not want to look at this. As you possibly know, there has been the Senate, the Australian Senate has, by one vote, has said, look, we should be looking at this. And the interesting thing is our government voted against this.
Yeah.
I can't understand it.
Well, it's politics. They don't want to be seen to have dropped the ball, and both sides of government, both sides of the parliament dropped the ball because they went about this the wrong way.
They did. They did. Yeah.
One last question. There's a story today about long COVID doesn't exist, according to some new research. You may have seen it in the Sydney Morning Herald. What's your feedback on that?
I only read the sports page of the Sydney Morning Herald. It's better. It's got better rugby union. Sorry, you guys in other parts of the country. What I think of that is that it's clearly whoever wrote that sounds like a standard Sydney Morning Herald 22-year-old reporter. What a load of nonsense. I don't see a lot of patients these days, but I can tell you half the patients I see are people with long COVID from the vaccine. Something like 70 to 80%, according to my friends in America, what they're seeing of long COVID is coming from the vaccine, not from the infection. And, you know, there are ways now we can sensibly attempt to try to manage this. But long COVID is a very real, very concerning problem. It's occurring in 5 or 10% of people after the infection. Not sure how many after the vaccine, but of course, so many people are getting the vaccine that the fact that I just do not have the time or opportunity to see the literally tens and tens and hundreds of people who are emailing me saying, can they come? And it's not because I'm very special. It's just there's so much of it around and so many. No one wants to look after these, or it doesn't seem to be, to look after these patients because it's hard and it's political.
Yeah, very much so. I'd love to speak with you again, Robert Clancy. It's great to have you for this short time. And thank you very much for your generosity.
My great pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Much appreciated. Robert Clancy, AM, Emeritus Professor at the University of Newcastle School of Biomedical Sciences and Pharmacy. If only the Australian government at the time had have listened to the offer from Robert Clancy to hear how we should have gone about this pandemic. Anyway, he won't say that. I'll say that. Thank you so much for your time. I'll get to a commercial break now and we'll come back very, very quickly and take your calls right here on TNT.
TNT Radio News.
News break! Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. French President Emmanuel Macron has warned Europe must prepare for war with Russia if it wants peace.
We must say that we are ready to respond. We must not be weak. The time has come for us to resist.
US Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has taken aim at Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu, calling for snap elections to replace the Prime Minister. And Beijing has slammed Washington's plan to ban TikTok of the US, saying such a move would violate international trade rules.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365, we never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad, listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk, this is TNT Radio.
It sure is, TNT. Thank you so much for your time, whether you're just listening or whether you're watching. You can watch on all the video streaming platforms right around the world. There aren't too many that don't carry TNT radio anymore. And so radio becomes television, which is why you can see what we do. And we thank you very much for supporting this particular news outlet, our global news outlet at TNT, just off the back of what Robert Clancy had to say. And I will catch up with him off air probably sometime next week. I've set it up with him already. Today, and we'll try and get him on once again to talk about other aspects of what we're discovering since the pandemic which is very important to cover. But in England, of course, right now in London, they've got this COVID inquiry, and there's a whole heap of controversy now about the fact that they're not looking at the things Brits want answers to, which is, why didn't the vaccines work as well as we were told? Why did I get COVID when I said that if I took the vaccine, I wouldn't get it? Why are so many of my friends suffering because of the vaccine, etc.? So there's all of that going on, but also some testimony which has been picked up by the Daily Skeptic today in London, and I thought I'd get this to you. The journalist wrote, "We have already written in the Daily Skeptic that the Welsh First Minister considered lockdowns a failed experiment and that Welsh government ministers were using disappearing messages." In other words, they didn't want to leave a signature during the pandemic, which could later be scrutinised as in a COVID inquiry. But all this pales into insignificance with the latest testimonies in Wales. In testimony, Simon Hart, the Secretary of State for Wales during the pandemic, said the different rules on lockdown were brought in for the sake of it. For the sake of it. You heard what Robert Clancy said. The national pandemic rules didn't state anything about lockdowns in the case of a virus of the size of COVID-19. No, there was no lockdown. But because China locked down, as in totally locked down their doors and windows, which enabled everyone who was inside to pass on COVID and not take advantage of outside air and separation, every other country in the world did the same. They thought, well, that's what you got to do. You got to lock down, despite the fact that nothing in the pandemic response indicated there should have been lockdowns. And so there you have it. Simon Hart, the Secretary of the State of Wales, saying, oh, we just locked down for the sake of it. This is now emerging after the pandemic. Like, it just makes you wonder why they did what they did. Well, they had no bloody idea. That's the story. Now, many health practitioners have followed the COVID narrative, as you know, of the government, of regulative authorities, without question. They followed along like sheep. Meh. My next guest dared to question the official narrative and didn't want to sound or look like a sheep. She looked outside of the box for ways to treat her patients with COVID-19. Now, bear in mind, at a time when the likes of Robert Clancy and another professor, Tom Barodi, was saying that you should be using ivermectin, you should be using the other drug as treatments, because we've known that in viral circumstances, they can be very effective used earlier on in the treatment. Well, Dr. Miley Trinh has all of that information in her head during the pandemic, and she got in strife because she decided to prescribe ivermectin to treat COVID-19. Now, why do you think she did that? She did that because she knew that the research said that it would help those with a coronavirus. And she's been standing up ever since for medical rights because she was suspended for prescribing ivermectin. She's still suspended for prescribing ivermectin. She graduated in medicine from the University of Sydney in 1992. This is a woman who came to the country as a Vietnamese refugee, basically working in sweatshops in places like Newtown and Marrickville. She was able to become a doctor on her own steam, working day and night, trying to earn a buck to keep alive and feed a family. And she did that in 1992, and she's been a general practitioner for 27 years. Miley owned and managed a successful medical centre in Baulkham Hills for over a decade. Everyone knew her in Baulkham Hills. She's a Christian and has lived out her faith by serving the poor in Cambodia for more than 12 years, providing free medical health care for local communities. Instead of being suspended from practicing medicine in her surgeries at Baulkham Hills, this is the sort of woman who should have been awarded Australian of the Year. The fact that we have medical authorities that prefer that she didn't practice medicine is a terrible reflection on the heartlessness of this country. Miley Trinh, welcome back to TNT.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Don't be silly. I understand you've received a legal judgment today. explain to my listeners and viewers what this case was specifically about and what the decision was. Can you do that?
Yes, sure. So today I was before the Court of Appeal and a judgment was passed concerning two matters that I challenged. So the first was challenging the legislation of the National Law Court Section 145D, bracket 1 of the National Law. And this law is, this legislation states that the Medical Council, both the Medical Council and the Health Commission, when they form an opinion that I am a danger to the public, so when they made a decision to suspend me and to stop me from practicing, it's an emergency power. It cannot be done without good reason.
Right.
So when they exercised that decision to suspend me under Section 150, they deemed that I'm a danger to the public, and for the protection of the public, I had to be suspended immediately.
So however, this is for prescribing a drug that I could walk into a chemist and get over the counter this afternoon?
No. So ivermectin is not available over the counter.
Right.
However, it is a safe drug, and in many parts of the world, it is available over the counter.
Yeah, it is available. Okay, so continue. So that was what you were trying to say, that this was for emergency purposes.
Well, no. So they saying that I'm such a danger to the public that I should be suspended immediately based on not very good grounds. However, because of the power that's available to the Medical Council to suspend doctors under such under emergency power, you don't really have a right to challenge it immediately. So they can exercise that power with very little basis, and you're suspended and you can't practice. However, the minute you're suspended, there's also another legislation called Section 145D, bracket 1. Now, this legislation requires the Medical Council to refer me to the tribunal so that I can have my matter heard at the tribunal, because the Medical Council do not have the authority to look into my matter. I have to be before a tribunal to determine whether my action was warranting a suspension or not. And so that is justice due to all health practitioners that have been suspended. However, the Medical Council have denied me that right by not referring me to the tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they don't refer me, it means that they can do whatever they want to me. And that means suspending me indefinitely. And that's what they have said to me, that I've been suspended indefinitely. Now, the thing is, the legislation...
Put that argument to the court, which sounds logical. And what was the court's reaction?
The court's reaction dismissed my case.
So dismissed your appeal?
Mm.
Yeah, you lost the case.
Right. I've lost the case. So I had two matters before the Court of Appeal last week, and both matters have been dismissed with costs awarded to me.
Okay. Did you think, and I'm just trying to think of another avenue for you, which might be the High Court, did you think that there were aspects of the law that were interpreted differently by the appeals court judges as opposed to judges in earlier courts?
Well, the earlier court was before the tribunal. So the tribunal really do not have authority over matters concerning law.
Right.
So whatever the decision of the tribunal is, it really doesn't really matter, because they don't have authority to make decision on points of law. So only the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal has that authority. So, however, I truly believe that the Court of Appeal, that's before three judges, they have got it wrong. We put in a very, very strong submission. We have good legal grounds, sound, solid legal grounds. And both of the matters that I challenge have legal groundings to win the case.
So, are you considering taking it further?
Yes, so I have spoken to my lawyers today, and we will have a look in details the reasons for the Court of Appeal judges for ruling against me. And we believe that we have got legal grounds to challenge it in the High Court.
Okay, their response to most of the questions that you ask would probably be, and I wasn't there, I don't know, but it would probably be that they have made these decisions to protect the public, right?
Well, it's not about that either. We're not challenging about the actual suspension.
Right.
We're actually challenging that the medical council have the duty and must refer me to the tribunal.
Right.
So,
I'm with you. Otherwise, you're in permanent limbo, right?
Yes. Well, that's it. I'm suspended indefinitely. What right does a medical council have to suspend a health practitioner indefinitely? The legislation would never allow the medical council to give them that authority to suspend anyone indefinitely.
The course of natural justice for mine,
no.
Because you're not having a definitive date for justice to be decided.
Well, the thing is, it's the abusive of power. So
yeah.
if I don't have the if they don't exercise that that power to refer me, they can suspend me as long as they want, and I never ever get to have a day in court.
And this is what's happening at the moment, right?
Yes. Well, while during the process of me challenging that, they have decided to refer me. So they have referred me, but it's the HCCC or the Healthcare Complaint Commission that have referred me, and they've referred me for prosecution. So I'm being prosecuted for practicing below standard, and they are they're wanting to cancel my license for 3 to 5 years and also making me pay for the cost of the hearing. So
when they get malicious, they get downright malicious, don't they?
Yes, I believe so. And I just think that just the fact that I refuse to, just the fact that I prescribe ivermectin, it's the reason why I'm being targeted.
And the ludicrous thing is, if you're a surgeon and something went terribly wrong in your surgery and someone suffered, suffered damage, they would end up, they would end up probably serving a suspension as well, but not a suspension in some cases as long as yours.
Well, that's correct. There have been cases where a doctor committed some sexual, indecent sexual assault, and they were allowed to go back to work after 6 months, 12 months suspension.
But
and
when
I've
you
suspended
prescribe
for
2 years. And during a COVID pandemic, and the only reason they didn't want you to prescribe it is because they were trying to contain the marketing, get people to focus on the vaccine and not focus on treatment. So because of those marketing definitions, you end up having this eternal, perpetual suspension. It is unbelievably unfair, and you should go all the way to the High Court, Miley.
Yes, and I believe that my legal team will look into this matter further, and we're most likely to proceed to.
I was just speaking to Robert. I was just speaking to Robert there. And Robert was saying to me that it is outrageous that doctors in Australia and in the United States were taken away from a practice that they love because they wanted to help patients. And it's a terrible outcome, this stuff. How many doctors in Australia still can't work because of what happened during the pandemic?
I don't know exactly how many, but what I've heard is that many doctors have chosen not to work. That means they decide to retire early instead of continue working. And many of the doctors who were going to suspend it were threatened to either retire or being suspended indefinitely. So they chose to retire. So these people were forced to retire.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Forced to hang up their stethoscope and leave a profession that they loved because they wanted to stand on their principles related to treatments for COVID-19. It is a disgraceful chapter in Australian history, this stuff, especially in reference to ivermectin, especially. You know, this rubbish that was spread by the CDC in the United States about it being a, you know, a horse tranquilizer, et cetera, it was so naive not to take notice of what ivermectin has been used for so many decades, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. Well, the thing is, the situation the doctor's facing is that you either, for a lot of us, we want to do what is right. And what doing what is right means treating patient with the best treatment available.
Yeah.
And ivermectin is the best treatment available, not the vaccine. And as we were right, the vaccine is, the mRNA vaccine is a new form of vaccine that's never been tested ever. And it is a form of gene therapy, as a lot of researchers have demonstrated. And it's dangerous to actually subject everyone in the, everyone in the population, even healthy young people, to be subjected to this novel vaccine. It's ludicrous for a vaccine that just been been tested for a few months.
And yet all around the world, you've had a change in heart on ivermectin. So we've got a status where if you prescribe ivermectin tomorrow, you would be in your rights to do so, right?
Yes. The restriction has been lifted in Australia. Yeah. So by right, any drugs that you technically, it's the decision of the doctor to treat what is best for the patient. So prescribing ivermectin, even at the time when I prescribed it, it was legal. It was off-label prescribing, and that was, the evidence suggests that was the best form of treatment for COVID-19. And I haven't broken the law. And I haven't prescribed ivermectin after it was banned. It was during the time when it wasn't banned.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredibly unjust, and I look forward to hearing the case before the High Court and a victory at the end of that process, Miley. Thank you very much for your time and giving us an update.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Dr. Miley Trinh, she's got her own surgery at Baulkham Hills, but she can't practice in it. Still, at a time when what she was suspended for is entirely permissible now. It is incredibly unjust, incredibly unjust. All because the marketing from the health department and the government said, push everyone into vaccines. Forget about treatments. We won't get enough vaccine takers if we tell people that they can take treatments. There's just something crook in Australia when that sort of stuff happens. Got to take a break, a little bit behind. Let's do that right now on TNT.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go. I didn't think I'd survive. But I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there.
Covenant House helped me break the cycle of homelessness in my family. They gave me the love that I needed.
Over 2,000 young people will sleep safely in a Covenant House bed tonight. When youth who are experiencing homelessness have a hot meal, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love, they can overcome heartbreaking challenges and have a brighter future.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding. I'm a speaker, I'm an author. Covenant House really helped me and really helped mold me into the woman I am today.
If you or someone you love is asking for help, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
Around here, bushfire is just a part of life. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. The people here all look out for each other. We're a community that does its bit to plan and prepare, to keep everyone safe. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
You're listening to Chris Smith
on today's News Talk Radio,
TNT.
Off the back of Miley Trin, which just makes me very, very angry, and I hate getting angry on a Friday, but off the back of her story and her defeat today in the Court of Appeal, Nev has decided to sum up the decisions of these agencies, the decisions of these courts, as they try and become malicious towards someone like her. Nev writes in the chat box on tntradio.live, all through history, it has been the same. No shortage of paid whores to do the scum's dirty work. How true. It's exactly how I feel. I want to tell you about 6G. Now, there was a lot of controversy over 5G and the health impacts of 5G. I've got to say, having read studies done on the health impacts of 5G from 2019 to 2016, this is a couple of years ago, I'm convinced that that was a little bit of a beat up. But 6G is a different kettle of fish. And let me explain this to you. Australia has signed an agreement with the governments of the United States, Canada, the Czech Republic, Finland, France, Japan, the Republic of Korea, Sweden, and the UK, covering the introduction of 6G mobile data technology. The existing 5G network spans only a fraction of the continent, though Telstra claims its network is the largest and covers 85% of the population. 5G is now available, at least partially, in all capital cities except Darwin, and in several regional centres in each state. There are no 5G deployments in the Northern Territory at present. Australians have been quick to adopt the technology. Counterpoint Research reported that the country had a 5G smartphone penetration rate of 82% in the first quarter of last year, representing around 8.8 million connections. In contrast, in France, Spain, Germany, and the UK, 5G handset penetration ranged between 20 and 30%. The advanced progress of 5G comes despite internet speeds in Australia being relatively mid-range. Now, this particular article goes through and compares our speeds in Australia with others around the world. We don't fare very well. We're not in the worst category, but we're not in the best category. And you'd think as a first world country, we should be near the top, but we're not. We're mid-range. While it's too early to say with any certainty, some experts predict that 6G will have a peak data rate of 1 terabyte per second for data transmitted in short bursts across limited distances. In other words, if you're in the city and you've got 6G, you'll never have a problem with downloading or uploading. Lightning fast, lightning fast. The multi-country agreement acknowledges that 6G is still more of a concept than a reality, committing the signatories to shared principles for the research and development of 6G wireless communication systems, because by working together, they can support open, free, global, reliable, secure connectivity. So they've signed up with a view for 6G to be present in, I think it's 2032 or something like that. Mobile developer Ericsson describes it as having the capacity to create truly omnipresent wireless intelligence. So they're talking about this 6G being like the AI of mobile connectivity. So it'll change the way we live and change our societies immensely. The countries that signed the agreement say they see the technology as facilitating the ability of participating governments and to keep individuals safe and resilient. But what about health impacts? Well, let me just tell you, 6G networks will use even higher frequencies than 5G. And there was a controversy about the high frequencies in 5G affecting our brains. First lab testing and pilots of 6G are expected to begin in 2028. So we won't have anything definitive until probably 2030. With commercial release probable in or near 2030, though Beijing has already launched a 6G test satellite. Of course, the Chinese have. The Australian study published in 2018 found no link between the increase in mobile phone use and the incidence of brain cancer. This is related to 5G. Like most modern technology, 6G uses radio frequency electromagnetic energy to transfer data. RF emissions can cause biological impacts referred to as thermal effects. Exposure to high radio frequency intensities can lead to the heating of biological tissues, that is the brain, which raises your body's temperature. High RF levels can result in tissue damage due to the body's inability to dissipate the excessive heat generated. Research on the impacts of low levels of radio frequency radiation is ambiguous and requires further study. They are known as non-thermal effects. So what they're talking about is a series of studies done in 2028 that we should all be looking at very, very closely, because now we're dealing with a high thermo heat that could affect the biological matter, especially if you're holding your phone like that on a repeated basis. Charlie Teo, the neurosurgeon, says to me he is convinced that there's been an increase in brain cancer because of the use of mobile phones. We'll have a better idea probably in 2030. So we've got a wild wait. I've got to get out of here. I'm off for a weekend. You have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday right here on TNT. See you later.